Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 114 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're talking about inciting incidents. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Anne Holly, StoryGrid editor and author of the upcoming historical love story, Restraint. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukrol from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.happybookreviews.com because nobody likes a sad book. You can make your book happy with reviews.
Hey, Anne, welcome.
Hi, Leslie. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so we got to do a couple of episodes this summer, and we're, you know, while Clark is on a break, I've invited some StoryGrid editors and a couple of other people, authors, to come and stand in. And I'm excited to have you back.
I'm excited to be back. Thank you.
And last time we talked about your story, which has that great, you have a great way of describing it.
Yes. Pride and Prejudice meets Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, that's so good. And it's funny because
it's a historical love story.
Right, right. And I think it's such a clear, easy way to describe it. It's just brilliant.
Thank you. Very high concept.
Yes, yes. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you. It'll be out soon.
Awesome. Yeah, anybody is interested in finding out more about Restraint or Anne and her editing services, you can stop by anneholley.net. That's AnneHawley.net. And we'll have that in the show notes as well. So I'm having guests come in, right? Because Clark is needing a break. And as a community, we can't help Clark with his health or, you know, rewrite his circumstances, but we could give him a little financial breathing room and get an amazing deal on his course that's advanced novel writing with Harry Potter. We've talked about that in the past, and some friends had this great idea to promote the course, and which is really great. It's a professionally recorded course. It breaks down the secrets behind, you know, why does Harry Potter work really well? And so it's really, really great stuff. And so there's a special right now, and the course normally retails for $197, but right now you can get it. You can pay anything you want and get the amazing course in its entirety. So if you are interested in checking that out, go visit thebookeditorshow.com/Potter. That's thebookeditorshow.com/Potter. And if you sign up there, and submit a question, I will do a special recorded Q&A for everyone as a bonus, everyone who signs up during this promotion. So you'll get an extra recorded Q&A with me. And there's some other bonuses too, if you go over there and check that out. So please be sure to do that. I've got a lot of announcements, so bear with me. We are getting to the story. But I also wanted to thank our good friend, Jari Bolander. He's the author of The Entrepreneur Ethos, How to Build a More Ethical, Inclusive, and Resilient Entrepreneur Community. And he has joined our Patreon crew. So We'll have his book and a link for you to check that out. It's a brand new book and I've read it and it's fantastic. So if you are entrepreneurially minded, then it would be great to check that out. Finally, we have the amazing Liz has put together, as I mentioned last week, the Google spreadsheet with all the Writership Podcast episodes, including the genre and the topics we discuss. And you can find those, or you can gain access to that at www.writership.com/index. So, all right, that's all the announcements. Do you have a quote for us today, Anne?
Well, I just happened to, yes. It is from our good friend Sean Coyne, the author of The Story Grid. And he says, like the peanut butter that lures a mouse into a mousetrap, the global inciting incident must be irresistible to the writer's intended audience. And yes, even the big literary writers have an intended audience. But alas, a fantastic global inciting incident does not make for a slam dunk commercial success. You must load every beat, scene, sequence, and act with tantalizing inciting incidents to keep the reader turning pages or to keep the viewer in their seat. Creating these kinds of inciting incidents is all about zigging when the reader expects a zag. They require singular imagination. Ideally, the writer fulfills the conventions of a particular genre's obligatory inciting incidents in a completely unique way, a way that the reader never sees coming. Tall order.
Yes, yes. And I was thinking there should be some suspenseful music that follows that. Yeah, so I could see someone reading this and thinking, oh, really? It's the way I feel when I think, oh, I have to feed my children again today, like every day. Yes, every day and multiple times. Yeah. So, because, right, a story is about change, so we have to change. The character has to change in some way. The character circumstances have to change. And so there has to be something that comes along and essentially whacks them on the side of the head and changes everything. Yep. And it can't just be one time. It has to be over and over and over again.
Yep.
Incrementally moving up and moving down and, you know, progressively complicating the circumstances of trying to get what they want.
Right. And what they need.
And what they need, of course. Yeah. So I love that quote because I love the peanut butter luring the mouse into the mousetrap. And that's what you do with the initial inciting incident. But then you have to keep doing it.
Yes. And you have to spring the trap over and over again, too.
Yeah.
It can't be all peanut butter. It has to be some snap.
Right. Yeah, and you don't want to do it the same way every time.
Right.
So there are lots of ways to innovate, as Mr. Coyne mentions there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's dive into our submission. Our submission for today is an untitled psychological thriller. The author is Sheila Lishway. And we have heard this story is going to be about 75,000 words. We have the beginning, which is kind of a prologue. And this is happening in 1973, whereas the rest of the story is happening much later. And just an advance warning, we have a bloody crime scene here. So if that is not going to work for you, then you might want to give this one a miss. So, all right, without further ado, we have an untitled psychological thriller. In the last few minutes of normal life that she would ever know, Kelly snuggles under the ballerina sheets, savoring the sweet and salty taste of grape Kool-Aid and Jiffy Pop. The red, blue, and green circles of the twister mat in her head. She giggles, remembering Kimmy and Bibi teetering over her unsteadily, laughing so hard until the threesome collapsed in a tangle of little girl arms and legs. Miss Nancy's new camera captured all of it on the white filmy square that Bibi took home with her. Kelly licks her lips again. She was glad the phone rang when it did, because she didn't have to brush her teeth tonight. Miss Nancy carried Kelly's pink toothbrush lathered in Crest with her into the kitchen. When she returned, it was nowhere to be seen. In fact, Miss Nancy didn't seem to care about teeth brushing at all anymore. Just hurry up, get into bed. Grown-ups are funny, thought Kelly, laying in the tiny bed, her sister's right leg thrown over her own. One minute, they're wearing party hats and blowing noisemakers. The next, their eyebrows are all smushed together and they don't want to play anymore. Wide awake, thirsty, and needing to pee, Kelly kicks off the sheets, grabs Ed Wrinkle's paw, and the two slide down off the bed. A flickering rainbow of light from the zenith in the living room illuminates her path into the hallway. Voices. Is Miss Nancy on the phone again? Kelly tiptoes down the hall, Ed's three felt paws dragging behind her. She drops to her knees and peeks around the corner into the kitchen. Frigid December air sneaks through the open kitchen door, sending a chill down the hallway. Not now. Please. Tell. Wrong. The whistling wind made it hard to hear. Need. Please. Ruin. Trash. Monday. Sorry. Between the legs of the kitchen table, Kelly sees blue jeans and boots through the hatched aluminum screen door. Miss Nancy is pushing the inside door closed. No, wait. Don't need. The outsider pleads, puffs of breath rising in the air. Shh, Miss Nancy says. We'll talk tomorrow. The door shuts, quieting the wailing winter winds. Kelly creeps backward down the hall, pulling Ed Wrinkles with her into the bedroom. Sitting on the toilet, she feels something bump the side of the trailer. A car door slams. Who was that? She wonders. It didn't look like any of the grown-ups she knew. Crawling back into bed, Kelly nestles next to her big sister. Kimmy sits up, white blonde hair in tangles, rubs her eyes, turns over, and lays back down again, pulling the covers up higher. Bladder relieved, Kelly's eyelids grow heavy and flutter. The winter wind whistles hard against the thin metal walls of the trailer. A slow screeching of the kitchen door interrupts her near slumber. Footsteps. Is Mommy here? I hope not. Nancy promised donuts and hot chocolate for breakfast. A kitchen chair scrapes the linoleum floor. Kelly grabs Ed Wrinkle's paw, and again, the two slide down off the bed. This time, Kelly is down on all fours right away, dragging Ed along with her as she scoots down the hallway towards the kitchen. It isn't Mommy. It's blue jeans and boots. A long brown braid falls from beneath the stranger's blue knit cap, a dark purple ribbon hanging loosely at the end, barely tied. Miss Nancy's legs come into view from the living room. What are you doing here? Nancy whispers insistently. I told you, I'm not changing my mind. Now leave. She steps toward the door, but in the next second, the white metal kitchen cabinets are sprayed red with blood as a baseball bat crashes into Nancy's head. Oh! Kelly flinches, sucking in air. Wide-eyed, she stares at the horror unfolding in front of her, saliva dripping from her mouth. Blue Jeans tucks the braid into the coat and swings again, lower this time, sending teeth bouncing across the kitchen floor like pebbles. Nancy stumbles against the refrigerator, whimpering. Sweat runs down Kelly's flushed cheeks. Shaking, she manages to back down the darkened hallway into the bedroom and peeks back into the kitchen through the cracked door. Miss Nancy's eyeglasses lay cracked and twisted on the floor. "Stop, please, stop," she pleads, desperately pawing the countertop. Blue Jeans steps on her glasses and laughs. "Phone's not gonna do you any good without these." Dangling the broken glasses from a black-gloved hand, Blue Jeans pulls the telephone cord out of the wall. Kelly watches her babysitter pat the counter, a hand finally landing on the edge of the porcelain sink. Nancy squints in the direction of the phone, her hand reaching into the sink, finding its target. Kimmy sits up in bed, startled. "What are you doing?" Kelly pumps her fingers against her lips. "Shh." Kimmy slides out of bed and crawls behind Kelly. She gasps when the bloody kitchen comes into view. "Shh," signals Kelly again. Blue Jeans winds the telephone cord around both hands, turns back to Nancy, whose arm is now raised, holding a pizza knife, pieces of cheese still dangling from its blade. Nancy plunges the knife into Blue Jeans' shoulder. Blue Jeans hollers, hands trapped in the cord. A leg kicks Nancy's groin, the knife dropping to the floor. Bent over in pain, Nancy pulls herself up yet again, desperately searching for another weapon. Blue Jeans shakes off the cord and picks up the knife, wraps an arm around Nancy's neck, and plunges the knife into her chest, over and over and over, her slippered feet kicking wildly until they slowed and moved no more. Blood spurts, Kelly thinks, like the broken drinking fountain at school, arching upward and in all directions. Blue Jeans pants hard, drops Nancy, her body hitting the floor with a thud. Only the knife's handle and a small bit of its blade are visible. The sisters clung to one another, hearts pounding. Distant talk show laughter eerily fills the trailer. "Under the bed," Kimmy whispers in Kelly's ear. Kelly nods and the two start to creep back away from the door, but Kimmy's foot bumps the metal wastebasket in the corner. They stop. Blue Jean's head whips around towards the clang. The girls watch as the intruder takes a cautious step into the dark hallway. Then another. Hands pull the knit cap lower. Two more steps. Holding tightly to one another, Kimmy and Kelly watch Blue Jean's gaze turn lower and in the direction of the cracked bedroom door. In the flickering light of the zenith, three sets of eyes make contact.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a great scene.
It's chilling.
It is. It's chilling and thrilling.
Yeah.
Exciting, especially from the point of view of such a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
Amps the danger up, the sense of terror, very strong.
Right. So, yeah, and I think some of this, some of the details that Sheila includes here are just, I mean, you know, we know it's a thriller, right? We're going to know that from the cover of the book, and you know, as we're buying it, we're not going to be surprised by it. But the way she kind of settles us in with this very normal kind of 70s childhood stuff with Kool-Aid and Jiffy Pop and Twister
and the Zenith TV.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then when things turn in this scene, they turn quickly, and it then, you know, like, and then it's like you're going down into this, you know, really scary place. And so I think that's a really, it's done well in that we, you know, it's the turning point is you can really feel it. I guess I should say.
Yeah, it's visceral. I mean, you do feel it. And I was going to comment that, you know, a phrase that we've heard a lot is that specificity creates universality, mm-hmm. which basically means these very specific details, the Polaroid picture, the mm-hmm. stuffed animal with a name, just the specifics of her life, even though I did not grow up in a trailer or with a mom who worked nights, it's so specific and so lightly done that I feel like I'm part of her life.
Yeah, we're pulled into that world very quickly, mm-hmm. and comfortably, because we're, you know, our first guide is this little kid who's just kind of looking at things and curious, and you know, who's that, and not, you know, not expecting obviously anything to happen. So even though we know something's coming, we kind of, you know, settle into that world.
Yes, and we don't have to settle into it for long. I mean, I counted, there's about 200 words of setup, of scene setting, mm-hmm. and then boom, with the action starts, the phone rings, and then pretty soon there's a knock at the door, and Blue Jeans and Boots comes in, and so we get a great deal in just this very short few paragraphs of her normal life. And not only her normal life, but the social situation that she's in. She's a little girl, so she doesn't have any judgment about how she lives, but we're looking at it from the outside and seeing a home where there's apparently no father, the mother is working nights, the babysitter doesn't really care too much about the kids, more about getting on the phone with her boyfriend or whatever is going on there. Mm-hmm. And it's a trailer park, and there's some very definite social status hints given there that I assume are going to come back into play as the murder is investigated later in the story.
Yeah, and I think you made the point earlier that, right, it's like it's just normal. This is normal for Kelly, for the babysitter to be on the phone with people, maybe,
and have,
you know,
boyfriends over because she's seen them mushing their eyebrows together.
Right. Yeah, and the adults are funny. That they can have party hats and noisemakers 1 minute, and then, yeah, and then it changes. So she's a keen observer.
Right, right.
Yeah, so when we're, so we, I wanted to mention again that this is happening on, you know, in 1973, and the story in the next scene takes place in present time, and so we're, you know, it involves the two generations later we have this unsolved murder and an investigative journalist who is looking into this, who's, you know, from the town, and, you know, connected to the people in this small town. And she's doing a sort of serial-like podcast to revive her public radio career. And so we don't know exactly how the story is going to unfold, but we do know that the author identified this as a psychological thriller. So we can kind of talk about this scene as an inciting incident, even if we don't know precisely if this is the one that kicks off everything. It is the event that kicks off everything. Like, the rest of the story couldn't happen without it. But for particular characters, there could be a different inciting incident. But as a crime inciting incident. I think this works pretty well. What do you think, Anne?
It works extremely well, and it contains, you know, it ticks three important boxes on the crime and thriller obligatory scenes and conventions list, which is you need a crime, you need a victim, you need a villain, and all three of those are right there in that scene. Mm-hmm. And the question that I have, and I think this is a good question for the reader to have at this early point in the story, is, okay, so is like that killer still at large? What happens to the two little girls? I mean, it raises these important questions that even though we know, presumably from the book cover and recommendations and blurbs or whatever, that we're going to turn the page and find ourselves in more or less, you know, modern times, 2017, then that also raises the question, apparently the murder was never solved. What happened in the, who, I mean, it raises all these great questions. So it incites me as a reader to turn the page, which is part of the purpose of an inciting incident.
Right. And the scene is kicked off essentially with this, in the last few minutes of normal life that she would ever know, Kelly snuggles under the ballerina sheets. So we get a little, right, the form of narrative drive there is dramatic irony. That is, we know more than Kelly knows in this scene. And, you know, we know her life is about to change dramatically.
Right.
So, we're immediately, we have tons and tons of questions and different questions than if we were just, then, you know, right, as we discussed in the episode discussing Esperanza over the summer,
right,
that there are different questions that the reader asks when they, you know, when they have different information. So we don't know like what's going to be revealed in the future about the story, but what we do know is that two little girls see who that is. You know, they don't recognize the person apparently, but they see who actually does it. And so, like, how fascinating, as you say, that this is an unsolved crime.
And we know that, I mean, we gather from our dramatic irony hints that Kelly survives.
Right.
We do not know that about Kimmy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a question. Another question that's very subtly raised in this scene is, this villain, the gender of the villain is carefully kept under wraps.
Right. Yeah, there's a long braid, but that doesn't confirm anything. And there's a purple ribbon, but again, that could go either way. It's not
that
like...
That could go either way, especially in the 70s.
Yeah, you
know,
right.
Who knows, hippies or something, I don't know.
Right.
but also, the author has been very careful to cover... to avoid any identifying pronouns. Mm-hmm. And yet I didn't notice the covering of identifying pronouns. I had to go through it a second time to say, I went back and said, okay, Braid, was this a man or a woman? Does she say? And she doesn't. But it wasn't obvious, like I wasn't being pounded over the head with lack of pronouns. It was very cleverly done.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It didn't stand out to me. And in fact, I assumed it was a man.
Well, we do that about harsh, brutal killers, don't we? We make that assumption, and that would be a good twist, wouldn't it?
Right. Yeah. So if we're looking at this, you know, as an inciting, you can, like Sean said in the quote that you read, right? There's an inciting incident for the global story. And then in each unit of story down to, you know, of course, the scene. We won't look at beats today. But in this scene, we can look at it and we can find the five commandments of story, of course, including the inciting incident, which is the thing that kicks off the scene, right?
Right. And I felt pretty strongly that the inciting incident of the scene was when... jeans and boots, blue jeans and boots, is that what
yeah.
the character is referred to as?
Yeah, blue jeans and boots.
Comes back. And the reason that I thought it was comes back rather than the first time that character appears is that from Kelly's point of view, everything up to that person coming back is normal life. Mm-hmm. She's accustomed to babysitters with boyfriends stopping by. I think this is all her normal life. It becomes abnormal and changes when there's a, you know, this person is forcing their way back in.
Yeah, because Miss Nancy.
Against the wishes of Miss Nancy, yeah.
Yeah, Miss Nancy said hit the road. And whoa, he's back. What's up with that? Yeah. And that, right, that's, so it's not, I mean, it's not earth shaking, right? You know, but it does, as you say, it doesn't have to be. The big thing, I mean, to me, the obviously the big thing in this scene is the turning point, you know, because so if we were looking at, again, the five commandments of story, inciting incident kicks us out of, or kicks the character, the point of view character, out of normal life. You know, whatever their existence was prior to that. And then you have progressive complications where it's harder and harder for the, you know, for the POV character to get things back into balance or to get things to restore the status quo.
Right.
And so
until the complication that makes it impossible.
Right. And turns the scene.
Right.
And so we have a pretty dramatic turning point here.
With, yes, involving a baseball bat.
Yeah, with the baseball bat. Like, it's all, you know, it's still all kind of, you know, it's weird. And Kelly's curious and concerned. But until the, you know, until it turns violent. Like, that's the turning point. That's the point of no return, right?
Yeah.
Can't, no way going back. And so then, you know, the next story commandment is the crisis question. So what is she going to do?
Yeah, and although it's not specifically stated, nor does it have to be specifically stated, the point of view character has a choice to make. And Kelly's choice in the scene is, I think, should I try? I mean, she can't help because she's a little 5-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. So, but she has to go warn her sister and hide and save herself.
Right, right.
And her choice is what am I going to do? And it's not explicit on the page, but she makes her choice.
Right. She goes back down the hall and she's, you know, she's still looking, you know, through the cracked door, through the doorway, but she's not, yeah, she doesn't, hey, you can't do that, you know, she doesn't try to interfere, which is obviously reasonable behavior for a young child in those circumstances. So
right.
so the climax, right, is her decision from the crisis question. So the question, you know, like, she comes, the turning point, what do I do?
Should I help or should I go help my sister?
Right.
Best bad choice.
Yeah. And then the climax is the decision. And then the resolution is, right, what, you know, what happens as a result, essentially? What's the new normal? And so here there's the, you know, there's the fight, which is, you know, that's all kind of part of the resolution, but the real resolution, you know, that we see is that Blue Jeans turns around.
Right.
Because Kimmy has bumped the metal wastebasket and Kimmy right. made a noise. And then Blue Jeans sees them.
And if I were to make one editorial comment on the structure of the scene, I would say that to tighten it up so that the crisis and the climax happen in immediate succession without interruption, I would suggest, whether, I don't know whether this is going to work with the larger murder mystery clues, you know, what actually happened, Kimmy's or Kelly's memories, but have her witness the entire crime rather than seeing the first, she sees it in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
And rather, I would editorially say, have her see the whole thing. The baseball bat, the teeth, the knife, the whole thing before she breaks away. Now, I'm not sure how I would structure that, but my feeling was, because there's the crisis of should I go or should I stay,
mm-hmm.
and then there's more crime happening before the climax kind of plays out and we get to the resolution. That would be one suggestion that I would make here.
Yeah, and I think obviously there are different ways to manage it, and we want to, look at it in the context of the bigger thing, but I think that's a legitimate consideration for these circumstances in this, in the scene where you have a little kid and, what is she going to do,
Yeah. Now, if in the playing out of the whole story, the little girl's seeing one thing, then backing away, and then seeing another thing is like a crucial clue in the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll be convinced. But right now, just reading it as a standalone scene, that's my thought.
Right. So we've talked about how this could be the inciting incident, right, for a global story that involves a crime, because we have the commission of the crime and discovery of the crime in one scene.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, those can be separated, but here we have them together. And we've looked at, so within the scene, there's an inciting incident when Blue Jeans comes back.
Right.
Returns. So I thought we could talk about a little bit about like inciting incidents and, what are the qualities and what do they need to have? What are the elements that they need? And so we know, right, I mentioned that the inciting incident knocks the world out of balance, right? So it represents a change. And so you can... There are different ways to think about this. Some people talk about it as the inciting incident, and Sean Coyne in the Q&A episode number, the Q&A part one of a recent episode of the podcast, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes, that he talked about there are different ways to think about the inciting incident if that term doesn't evoke for you what it really is. And so other ways to think about this include the call to adventure in the hero's journey or in the Kubler-Ross grief change process. This is shock. And Sean also called it the punch to the gut. Right. It's like,
I think he says punch to the solar plexus.
Oh, solar plexus. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But so, and those are all just different ways of saying basically something's changed. The character can't ignore it. And so like if the character could go on their merry way, after this has happened, then it's not really an inciting incident. Now they may move into denial where they're not really gonna deal with it, but it's a change that they really can't ignore.
Right. And in the hero's journey, there is the call to adventure. And then very often there's a refusal of the call at least once mm-hmm. before the hero accepts the call. So yeah, there can be that denial.
Right.
For a little while, but if you don't quickly get out of that as a writer, you don't get the story past that point, there's no story.
Right. And then if to get really granular in, down into the inciting incident, Robert McKee in Story talks about how the protagonist's life is thrown out of balance. The protagonist wants things to go back to normal, as we do when something changes and it's not a positive thing. Even sometimes if it is a positive thing, we kind of crave routine and the way things work because we know how it works. And then the protagonist, you know, might consider, you know, what can I do to get things back to the status quo, or at least make things better? And so within the character, through the inciting incident, they decide on essentially a remedy or a goal, or also called the object and objects of desire, that they think will, that they begin pursuing as their remedy.
Those four points are really useful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's important to point out, for a global story inciting incident, for the inciting incident of a whole novel, concepts like being thrown out of balance and longing for things to go back to normal, those are big and dramatic, but in every scene, you need an inciting incident, and it doesn't have to be that dramatic. Mm-hmm. It's one of the problems with the terminology sometimes, is that you feel like, oh, in every scene, do I have to have this life-altering event? No, you just have to nudge someone off of a center, you know, where they've been standing.
Right. Yeah. So here we have a stranger knocking on the door a second time. It's, you know, in the scheme of things, I mean, we're thinking, oh, that's not cool. But
from Kelly's point of view, it's just, okay, this is a little bump in the road. Literally, there's a bump on the side of the trailer.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting,
very interesting
piece in the story there.
And she's not going to be able to go back to sleep without, you know, satisfying her curiosity at least a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, but.
And going to the bathroom.
Yeah, well, that too. But yeah, so like, it's not a big, you know, like, that's not the big scary thing that happens. Right. It's a mild thing, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
So the inciting incident can be, as I mentioned, it can be a positive or negative thing, right? Pride and Prejudice. Hey, Bingley moves into the county. That's awesome.
Yeah. Handsome rich guy moves in next door. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's good. That's good for a family with five girls. And of course, negative, we can see that, you know, I just pulled the murder of Roger Aykroyd, because we had talked about that at the Story Grid certification, that, you know, where the titular character has been murdered. And so that's not a very good thing for him.
Right. And probably not a very good thing for just about anyone.
Right, yes.
He will be the murderer.
Right.
Well, and there can be causal and coincidental inciting incidents.
Right, right. So can you break that down a little bit?
Sure. A causal inciting incident is, for example, a stranger knocks at the door. Somebody does something with consciousness.
Right.
And we have a stranger knocks at the door inciting incident in this scene. Literally, mm-hmm. The stranger comes back. A coincidental inciting incident is lightning strikes. There's a storm. It's external to anybody's consciousness or choice. Caused by, generally by nature, you know, or coincidental, it happens to you, nobody chose it, there it is, often natural or environmental.
Right, and just that, like, contrast the two in the same sort of situation, is like, causal would be stealing a suitcase from the airport, whereas coincidental would be accidentally taking the wrong suitcase at the airport.
Right, and two very different stories spring to mind immediately when you say those two things.
Right, yeah.
And it's not always perfectly clear-cut. I mean, is the airline losing your luggage causal or coincidental? Probably coincidental.
Yeah, probably. Let's hope.
Yeah. Yes, let's hope it's not to lose your
luggage. I don't want to ascribe, you know.
No, we have to fly.
Negative intent.
To the airlines, yes.
Right. So, and then there's one other thing that Robert McKee mentions in Story, is that you can have one event or two. So you can have, like I mentioned, like this scene includes the actual crime plus discovery of the crime. But you often have them, they'll be separated. And he gave the example of of in Jaws, there's a shark attack, and then later the sheriff finds the body. So it can be one event, or it can be essentially a setup and payoff in that way. So there, you know, you have options, but basically there has to be, you know, there's an event and then there's awareness of the event, and they can come together or be separate.
And I think in many crime stories, especially murder mysteries, it's very often separated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I was trying to think of other sorts of examples.
Yeah, I'm drawing a bit of a blank right off the top of my head.
I was like, I wrote down Star Wars, but yeah, anyway, the point being, right, yeah, that you can have it. And those are two examples. And I thought, actually, yeah, see, that's another, it's, you know, that involves a crime in the Bonfire of the Vanities. The protagonist hits a victim with his car. But anyway, so.
Well, and here we have, I mean, in this scene before us, we have a crime and discovery of the crime in one sense, because a little girl witnesses the murder.
Mm-hmm.
But discovery of the crime typically is by authorities, officials, adults, somebody who can take action.
Mm-hmm.
So that hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And
right.
From the prospectus, you know, what we might have read on the book jacket and what this author has provided as something of a synopsis, we already know that that actual discovery isn't, you know, the more adult real world discovery isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
For a while. Yeah.
For a while.
I mean, obviously, it will happen, and it will be a game changer for the whole community, et cetera. But so there is that there will be that separation here, too, in one way of looking at it.
Mm hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the reasons we want to turn the page is, oh my God, are there any grown-ups alive? Is anyone going to come and help? I mean, that's a question.
But... Yeah. Yeah, how is that going to... Well, yeah, I mean, there's so many great questions. Ah! Like, it's almost overwhelming, because you're getting a lot of the physical details of what's actually happening, but there's so much behind it that we don't know. And I think that's something that makes for a very powerful inciting incident, is that if it's, you know, like if it can grab you that way and leave you with lots of great questions, then there's no question you're going to turn the page.
Yeah, exactly. And I was certainly ready to turn the page on this one. One thing that I don't know if I've said this before, but I'll say it just in case. In writers' groups and critique groups and so on, very often you get a comment on your work that says, but can you tell me more about this? Please put in more detail. I want to understand. And for the writer, I think it's very important to take that and say, good, you're asking the right questions. That's exactly where I want you. And not put all those details in just because some beta reader in your writer's group said, I want to know more. Good. Mm-hmm. You want to know more. I'm on the right track.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been there and I've said that. But, you know, we all have our worldview maturation plot going on.
Yes, we do.
And so, yeah, like that it's, if you answer everything, if you reveal everything, then... You know, I mean, of course, there may be circumstances where you would want to reveal more than we have here. But in these circumstances, I think this is an amazing setup for...
I do, too. I think the author has threaded that needle very well here. Mm-hmm. Not answering too much. Not answering hardly anything. Just enough so that I know these are little girls. I have a very clear sense of the life that they live. It's just right. It's very well done.
Yes, yes. Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I'll take a quick look here at my notes. I think I did want to say that there is some a little bit of in my feeling, a little over elaboration of specific details in the scene. This isn't real specific to inciting incidents, but and I just wanted to say that in early drafts we all do that. I'm telling myself as a writer that, you know, there's Kool-Aid and there's Jiffy Pop and there's Twister and there's donuts and there's a lot of elaboration of specificity, and on a second or third draft going back through, some of that could probably come out. There's some duplication of ideas. It's the only thing that I find in here that I would comment on at sort of a line edit level. But I don't think it's a problem at this early stage. I think she said she's not quite even finished with the story yet. I'm not quite sure where she is with it.
I think she'd
full draft.
I think she'd finished the draft, but it's nowhere near.
Yeah, it's an early draft. Yeah. So there are a couple of like two or more sneaky journeys from bedroom to kitchen, two mentions of Ed Wrinkles the toy, two or three or four references to the cold December air. All of those things are, each one of them is good, but they're candidates for converging into single instances, because when you rewrite, you get to where you trust your reader to follow you more.
Yeah,
and so some of the things don't need elaborating, but it's a very small thing. But when you're trying to launch a rocket like this straight up in the air with a thrilling inciting incident for a crime thriller, or however she's defining the psychological thriller, a few of those specific details go a long way, and a few more sort of slow down that launch a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, well, so I just happen to have an editorial mission.
Joe, imagine that.
I know, it's shocking. Very shocking. So I want to encourage everyone to write an inciting incident. So identify the inciting incident in one of your favorite stories. And look at that. And ask yourself these questions about it. Does the event upset the balance? Does it, you know, does it change the protagonist's life in a pretty big way? And does the protagonist react to that event? You know, internally, externally, however, do they have, you know, is it something that they must respond to in some way? And does it trigger the object of desire? You know, whatever that is. And then the, you know, does the decision to, you know, or that object of desire and the decision to essentially pursue the object of desire, the thing that they think will bring them back into the status quo, like, are all those parts there, those elements? So once you've identified those elements, then I want you to draft an inciting incident for a story. You can use characters of your own that you've already been working with. You could write about something that's happened in your life. You could just take a random character, place, and problem. But whatever you do, draft the inciting incident for that with all of that, you know, having read that scene from your favorite story. And then once you can do that if you have a draft of your own story and you want to look at that specifically, that's a great idea too. You can obviously look at that, ask those questions, and then revise accordingly. You know, make that really strong. Make that event something that throws things out of balance in a way that's consistent with the genre, you know, the story that you're trying to tell, and so on. So making sure that all of those elements are there so you can practice and you can assess your own story. So this editorial mission and all the editorial missions you can find at writership.com/episodes, and you can have those delivered right to your inbox if you sign up at the same address. if you usually listen to the podcast on the go, this is a great solution because you can't write down while you're driving or cycling or running.
Or doing the dishes.
Right.
So remember, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.happybookreviews.com because nobody likes a sad book. You can make your book happy with reviews.
Okay, and Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club cover hosting and technical support for the show, but our Patreon crew supports our time in preparing and recording. We have a new reward at the quartermaster's level, the Writership Podcast Book Club. But it's, of course, not just any book club. We wouldn't do that. Each month, we'll choose a book or a story from suggestions, and I'll read it and analyze it the way I would for a sort of structural story level edit. And then we'll discuss it in a recorded call. So for more information about the book club or other ways to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/writership. Additionally, if you enjoy the show and want to show your support, you can leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. If you want to have your 5 pages reviewed, please visit writership.com/submissions. Don't forget that you can get Clark's Harry Potter course for a limited time for pay what you want, and with lots of really great bonuses. So you can visit, you can learn more about that at thebookeditorshow.com/potter. That is it for episode 114. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Bye.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.